It's Wednesday, February 27th, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, questions about the future of libel laws in this country, as one of the Supreme Court justices suggests that it's time to review some of the landmark cases that empower journalists to aggressively cover public figures. And what happens when technology gets involved? It's a complicated question and one that we'll get into. We've also got updates from the Cook County Criminal Courts building in Chicago, where both Jussie Smollett and R. Kelly were arrested and charged. We'll get into the next chapters of those ongoing stories and the ways that they've been covered. And efforts to silence journalists around the globe, from Maine, where singer Don McLean tried to squash coverage of an exhibit around domestic violence, to Arizona, where a cop threatened to arrest a 12-year-old reporter, to Venezuela, where President Maduro detained a crew from Univision. And then there's Australia, where the conviction of Cardinal George Pell was suppressed for nearly 2 months, and now more than 100 journalists are facing jail time for contempt. So they sat in that courtroom for months and months, then sat on the verdict from December until now. The stories that they had been writing all that time, the sidebars that went along with them, all beginning to see the light of day Monday and Tuesday.
And that's because, for those of you who might think you know a lot about press freedoms and the First Amendment from this country, wondering what the heck is an order of suppression and how does a judge in Australia decide to say you can come and cover this trial, but you can't report anything to the public about it till I tell you to, till I remove the order, which just happened this week. I mean, it's really interesting because this is one of the most powerful people in the Vatican, in the Catholic Church, and he's been convicted. And until it was determined that there was not going to be a second set of charges filed on behalf of other victims, that gag order was basically in place. And the news organizations that tried to get around it had to try to find clever ways to do it, like putting all black on their front page of their paper. We can't tell you what happened with this prominent Australian figure, but you can go check it in other places. And that's the ironic part about it. I mean, American news organizations, people on social media around the world were telling us that this cardinal was convicted, and yet journalists whose job it is to inform the public weren't allowed to do it.
Yeah, to me, I think that's where the law itself runs into some issues when you start talking about where we are in terms of media technology and the ability of audiences to be able to get news and information from various sources around the world. It's difficult for a gag order like that to stand up when you're in that kind of environment. But, I mean, the other issue that I have here is that, you know, the Australians knew about this. They knew that the verdict had been out there. The gag order comes out. You don't get that depth with the daily coverage that you would normally get if you saw this happen in an American courtroom and see all that play out. So now they're all playing catch up right now, and that's an issue I have, is that the public that is as close to this as possible is now playing catch up because of this gag
order. Of a concerted effort to keep them from having access to the information.
And I understand that you're trying to protect the legitimacy of the court and what could possibly happen in the future in terms of future litigation that could happen, but at what expense? I guess that's the issue.
Here's the expense. These orders of suppression, you know, in a vacuum, you can make a legal argument for them, but they're almost always used to protect important, powerful people, not other folks, the run-of-the-mill folks who get involved in the legal system. And because of that, these people who have an outsized impact on society and on the news, they're the ones that get the break.
Right.
Okay, so Univision's Jorge Ramos has been deported from Venezuela after the Maduro government detained him and his crew on Monday. Ramos was interviewing Maduro, asking him about the lack of democracy in that country, the torture of political prisoners, and a growing humanitarian crisis there. The president abruptly stopped the interview after Ramos showed him video of young Venezuelans eating from a garbage truck. He's known as someone who likes to kind of inveigle political figures to begin with. We've seen him do it with Donald Trump. We've seen him do it with others. there can't be a whole lot of surprise that that one-on-one conversation with Maduro didn't exactly go well.
No, I don't think there was a surprise there. And there also wasn't a surprise that Maduro took some sort of action against him. To me, the surprise was how quickly the State Department under President Trump acted to assist him in getting out of the country when it looked like he was going to be either stuck in the palace or stuck in a hotel for a longer period of time. But because of their action, you know, he was able to get out, especially in light of the fact that he's not a Trump supporter. Trump has, back during the election, threw him out of several of his campaign rallies because he didn't like the way in which he was interviewing him or asking questions. So, you know, that's the surprise to me in how quickly the State Department acted on this.
I like the fact that the State Department did weigh in, especially given how, as we've talked about in the past, the president's comments about the media are telling dictators in other countries, it's okay, they're fair game to take
it's
off
telling
after
people
the media.
In our own country, it's possible to
And
do
if this
that.
Didn't fit the foreign policy objectives of the Trump administration right now, I'm not sure how hard they would have pushed. But that being the case, and yes, it's true, some people do think that Jorge Ramos is kind of a grandstander, kind of like Jim Acosta at CNN is accused of being a grandstander. He did call him a murderer and a dictator allegedly in the interview, then pulls out the iPad and shows the kids eating out of the garbage truck. Of course, he was looking for a gotcha moment. On the other hand, no matter what you think of the journalist, a democratically elected president, as Maduro claims to be, doesn't detain journalists and doesn't confiscate their equipment. That just doesn't
happen. And it hasn't just been Ramos. There were, I believe it was six journalists who were detained in similar types of situations and environments in the month of January alone. That this is part of the strategy, if you will, of Maduro and his government.
Yeah, I mean, and the journalists are under assault daily at the border trying to cover what's happening there in the human rights crisis in which we have organizations trying to get food, medicine, and other things to the people of Venezuela, you know, during this crisis. And so they're trying to cover that, which is probably the most important part of the story of what's happening in Venezuela right now. And they're the ones, I think, that should get more coverage of what's happening to them in their efforts to try to show the world what's going on there.
Okay, well, you might remember that a few years ago we introduced you to Hildy Lysiak. She's the now 12-year-old girl who has, with her parents' support and help, run a hyperlocal news site down in Arizona that gives the pros a run for their money. Well, it seems that Hildy is experiencing some of the same challenges that reporters much older than she are experiencing as well, people who are trying to stand in the way of her reporting. She published this video on her website, Orange Street News.
You stopped me earlier and you said that I could be thrown in juvie. What exactly am I doing that's illegal?
So, when I left the office, you were over there talking and you quickly, you taping me? You can tape me.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
But what I'm gonna tell you is if you put my face on the internet, it's against the law.
Okay,
in Arizona,
I can blur it.
Okay? So I'm not giving you permission to use my picture or my face on the internet.
So the police officer's face does appear very briefly in that video. She published it, like I said, on her website. Was he just bullying her?
Yeah, I mean, if he's got the equivalent of a police chief, is the way I understand it.
Right.
And if the police chief of this town doesn't know that, in fact, it is legal in Arizona for somebody to tape a law enforcement officer out in the public streets, then he's not a very good sheriff. He probably was just bullying her. And I really appreciate the grit that she showed.
Assuming that she was too dumb to know what her rights were.
Right. But he didn't know enough about her, I think.
Apparently not.
But she captured
She's the same girl who uncovered a murder in the town three, four years ago. That's how we came to know about her in the first place.
And you want to talk about, you know, determination. She's actually from Pennsylvania.
Right.
And that's where her news site is based, but she decided to do a story about immigration. She goes to the border. So this is a pretty sharp 12-year-old girl.
Yeah, when I first read this story, I had to go back and I remember we had talked about it before and I was going like, what was this guy thinking? You know,
I'm sorry, it's not funny. I'm doing one of those laughing at things that aren't funny again.
I mean, you know, he could have handled that so much differently, but I think it was, you're right, he was trying to bully her and thinking that by being a sheriff and having a badge and driving in a big truck that she's on a bike, that somehow that's going to intimidate her from actually reporting on what was going on. I mean, it's and now he's in trouble with his bosses because he didn't handle it well, and he's brought, you know, this all of this publicity down on the town, and it was just uncalled for.
And you want to talk about being serious for a second on this story, Amy. Who was the adult in this situation?
A 12-year-old girl was the adult.
Look what she did after all this happened. She goes online and says to the trolls who are taking the sheriff's picture and his contact information, saying, call him up and harass him. She's told people to not do that on social media. Who's being the responsible person there?
Yeah.
Well, the other part of it, too, I was taken aback by her presence of mind in that moment. So she may not know if he's feeding her a line that you can't put my face on the internet in this state. So she has presence of mind enough to not only keep her calm, but to shoot the ground.
Yeah.
And to make sure that she's still capturing that moment. She's documenting what happened to her, getting it, and then figuring out what to do with it later. That's something that people twice, three times, four times her age don't always, I don't know that I would have that presence of mind.
Right. I mean, to me, the other thing is that she's out there reporting on a story that local media in the area hadn't been reporting on involving immigration. And for some reason, he didn't like the way in which she was doing it or the fact that she was doing it at all. And he felt the need to try to bully her into stopping her doing that. That's unconscionable to me right there.
Okay, so we've got one more story of a threat against a news organization. This one comes out of the state of Maine. And the person making the threat, Don McLean. Yep, the guy who sings American Pie. What's he unhappy about? Coverage of an exhibit that his ex-wife put together that's on display in their town's public library.
She's created not only an exhibit, but an audio recording that she claims is her recollection of their relationship and the abuse she suffered.
He did not apologize. We did not acknowledge the Jekyll and Hyde transformation or the ugly bruises all over my body.
Patricia McLean was traveling, but we spoke to her by phone about her new exhibit.
I just want to show what it looks like when you basically lift the veil and you want to see domestic abuse in its face. This is what it looks like. It's bruises on women's arms, and there's statements of protection of abuse orders.
She says after her husband pleaded guilty to domestic violence charges, other Maine women started to talk to her about their own domestic abuse situations. 12 of those women, including some from the Camden area, are featured in her exhibit.
So the argument that he is claiming here is that her exhibit could potentially harm his career in a way that he will not be able to recover from.
Well, I mean, first of all, he pled guilty.
Right. And in fact, the video shows his mugshot from those charges.
It doesn't appear to be having an immediate impact on his ability to perform. I mean, he had concerts scheduled after the fact. He's bringing in audiences. But regardless, whatever she is doing, if he wishes to sue her for defamation or whatever, fine. But journalists covering what she is doing in a public space, how did he actually think that intimidation was going to work? Now, these are small town papers, and they did take the story down briefly so the lawyer could check it out.
Yeah.
But then, good for them, they put the story back up.
Right.
They put the threatening letter from the lawyer, and then they had a full discussion.
I mean, I think he's bringing by going at
he's creating the problem.
He's creating
for himself.
The problem. I mean, he's definitely created the problem because, you know, instead of, as Mike said, you know, challenging her directly, either through legal means or some other means, he went after the newspaper, and he had no standing to do that whatsoever. And he did it through his attorney. The question in my mind is, his attorney wasn't smart enough to go like, this isn't going to work because they have
billable hours or billable hours.
Well, billable hours. There you go.
You can hire an attorney. Yeah. You can take up a case. It doesn't mean you're going to win.
And in fact, what you've done is you've created more of a problem for yourself and your reputation than if you had just left it alone.
Again, I'm going to say for the second time in as many weeks, we're now in a situation where here we are in mid-Missouri talking about something we wouldn't have otherwise even known about had this stink not been made.
Absolutely.
The timing of this is interesting, though unrelated. It's happening at the same time-ish that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is calling for a review of the libel laws and suggesting that it's time to send some of those cases back to the states. And one of the landmark cases that's really at question here, New York Times versus Sullivan, it's been what has made some of the best journalism of generations, of modern times, possible.
Yeah, and when President Trump, as a candidate, was saying he was going to change the libel laws to make it easier to sue the media, most of us said, it's not going to happen because the New York Times versus Sullivan case is there. Now, if you've got only Justice Thomas making this case, it's still not something to worry about. But if other justices got behind it, it would be difficult. And as you say, Sullivan was a case that allowed journalists, it stemmed from the civil rights era when politicians in the South were using the libel laws to keep journalists from being able to cover those stories aggressively. And what it basically says is, if you're a public figure, and how that gets defined is interesting, but if you're a public figure, you have to prove that journalists showed malice. That is, they knew what they were reporting was false, or they didn't care. They just disregarded whether it was false or not in doing their reporting. And that is a high bar deliberately set so that public figures can be covered without concern about being sued all the time.
You know, what I find interesting about Justice Thomas, his comments here, is that none of the other justices even weighed in at all. I mean, and that in and of itself speaks volumes because it wasn't revolved around a particular case. I think they were dealing with another case, and he just came out and said, I think that this needs to be, that this needs to be looked at again, and maybe it's not constitutional. I mean, he flat out said that Sullivan was not based on the Constitution. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, hold up a second. I mean, it was a unanimous decision, and for you to come out now and say, well, maybe all nine justices at the time were wrong, I mean, that's a little bit far-fetched.
So let's change the circumstance a bit. Remember in November, we introduced you to this experiment in artificial intelligence from the Xinhua News Agency in China.
I will work tirelessly to keep you informed as texts will be typed into my system, uninterrupted. I look forward to bringing you the brand new news experiences.
So that was an artificial intelligence anchor basically programmed by somebody simply typing it in the computer, and a computer-generated image of a real-life person simply delivering the news. So what happens when it's machine learning or artificial intelligence that ends up libeling someone? Who and how do you consider responsibility?
The problem is that people have this assumption that artificial intelligence is somehow, it's totally unbiased. It's based on reading
and
of the
humans
data.
Humans had nothing to do with it.
Humans have everything to do with seeding the program, writing the program, right, coming up with the data that's used to analyze and come up with some sort of conclusion. Yeah. And so that is going to be the case. People, journalists, are going to be responsible. Maybe until the point in time someday when artificial intelligence really is intelligent, right, if that's possible, as a conscience or ethics or morals or whatever. But that's not the world we live in today.
I mean, if you go back and you look at the tape, it basically says that someone's typing this in, mm-hmm, and that's the person who can be held liable, for what goes out on the air or what's being sent out through social media or whatever. And that, until that changes, as Mike said, you're still going to have, someone can still be sued. A human individual or individuals can be sued.
And here's the problem for a lot of people in news organizations. These algorithms, once they start processing enough data, kind of the decisions that are being made are in this black box. You don't really know the logic behind why certain content is being published or data is being analyzed in a certain way. And if you can't explain to a judge or attorneys or victims how it was that this algorithm came up with the information it did, that's not a very good defense.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, there was a fascinating piece in the Tribune this weekend that I want to ask the two of you about. It was a follow-up on an investigative series written by Lexi Churchill and Waverly Koval about the handling of Title IX cases on campus. The follow-up this weekend, it centered on the reassignment and forced resignation of two university employees, basically for talking to the reporters. Now, both women who were the subjects of, the ones who were quoted in the story, I shouldn't say the subjects of the story, but the ones quoted in the story were given the opportunity to resign and chose to do that, reassigned to other places in the university. There are a lot of people who are wondering how it's possible that if they were going out there and talking about problems and trying to bring truth out there, how it was they aren't covered in some way by some whistleblower protection.
Well, I mean, because there is no whistleblower protection. I mean, that's the answer to your question.
Well, right, I was looking for you to say that to me, Ernest.
I mean, there's no whistleblower protection. What I found fascinating about reading this story was the fact that number one, they were given the opportunity to resign from that position, but then reassigned, and of course, they still can't talk about the issues involved in
that
this.
That was one of the conditions.
That was one of the conditions of the resignation. Mm-hmm. What I also found fascinating here is that the office that they were both working in is still operating, and they brought some other people in. It's not staffed at the level it was when they were there, but it's still operating. The university is still basically still saying that, you know, we're doing all these things, but it hasn't answered the question as to, number one, why were they asked to resign? Why were they reassigned somewhere else, or could at least apply for other jobs? And what's happened moving forward, other than to say, well, we are responsibly working with our students in the RSVP, which is the organization, to help students get through these various problems that they're having in terms of violence and sexual assault.
The stories were in the Columbia Daily Tribune. Mm-hmm. They were written by Missouri School of Journalism student reporters, and I thought they did an excellent job of telling the story. They might have made a little bit of a mistake in terms of what happened to their sources in sending emails to their university email addresses asking them to confirm the quotes that they had given. But I tell you, the bigger part of this thing...
Talk about why that is a little bit, so that our audience can understand that.
The
three of us get that.
Yeah. The university obviously has access through its IT programs to all the emails of its employees and has the right to look at them.
Right.
And so, of course, they could determine who it was that were the sources for the stories if it wasn't obvious in the reporting. But the other thing I think is really interesting to me, and I hope there's more reporting on this, universities find themselves in a really interesting situation trying to adjudicate sexual assault and mm-hmm. harassment under Title IX. I mean, they're being asked to be quasi-legal experts in what's happening, and yet they're not in the criminal justice system. And so the protections for both victims and accusers is not the same thing. And this leads to all kinds of decisions that have to be made, political and otherwise, that I think a lot of universities would rather not have to make. Right. Were it not for the fact that they're simply trying, we hope, to protect their students as best they can under the federal rules they're operating.
And the rules and regulations under Title IX have changed from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. And so now, you know, whereas in Obama it was more victim-centered, now all of a sudden you're having to shift in those rules to quote-unquote, be more fair to those who are being accused. So it puts universities and the systems that they've created in a very awkward position.
Okay. It's no secret. We tape this program on Wednesday afternoons, and it runs in the evenings on KBIA. Last Wednesday night, about 6:45, I texted both of you and pointed out how lucky we were that soon after our discussion about the coverage of Jussie Smollett, prosecutors in Chicago announced there were charges filed against him, which led to the next chapter in the media circus at the Cook County Criminal Courts building in Chicago. Friday, another ring formed as the state's attorney announced sexual assault charges against singer R. Kelly. This led to a 5 or 6 day campout outside of 26th and Cal. Monday night, I saw what I personally thought was a great tweet from a reporter from the Chicago Tribune, Jason Meisner, who said they were covering this and following R. Kelly around like he was the Stanley Cup, the way that after that would be awarded, that you went from bar to bar to bar as they followed R. Kelly from the jail to McDonald's to the next place he went. Talk for a minute about just this three-ring circus that became those two stories together.
Well, I mean, if you talk about the Smollett story, I mean, it's, as we talked about last week, I mean, it started out where everyone was somewhat in shock that this had actually happened to him. And then, you know, a couple of days later, a week later, you find out from the Chicago police that all of this allegedly was
it just did not add up.
Just didn't happen, and that he orchestrated it all. And then so those charges were filed, and as you said, the circus was out there at the courthouse, as usual, to basically say, to ask him or his attorneys, how did this happen? Did he really do this? All the usual things. And then a couple of days later, you get R. Kelly, which has been a circus for a long time that has finally come to fruition, not because of the news media, but because of Lifetime Television. So there you go.
which kind of makes you feel for Jim DeRogatis, who has literally been on this case and trying to bring awareness for the better part of 28 years.
Yeah. And I thought that the local journalists in Chicago, as was pointed out in one of the pieces on the Lynx blog, mm-hmm. did a better job than the national media in trying to not jump on this story with both feet before all the facts were in, and to follow up afterwards. But, you know, I hope, as we talked about last week, that once these cases, these celebrity cases, pass from the headlines, that the media will focus on other instances of racial discrimination and sexual assault of women in Chicago or elsewhere. The police chief, I thought, was pretty sober in saying that the media had a responsibility to look in those stories as much as they looked into these.
I'm with you on that, Mike. I would hope. I mean, I share your hope, but I'm not optimistic that the media is going to focus on the everyday issues of this and not when it's someone who has star power or political power, which is what we tend to do mm-hmm. over and over and over again. And what gets lost in that are the people who are really hurt by this, the women and others who are hurt by these issues who don't have that sort of star power and that appeal.
Okay, we've got one last update for you before we go today. The publisher and editor down in Alabama who wrote the editorial calling for the Klan to resume night rides and lynchings in D.C., he has stepped down from his role as editor of that paper. He does still own it. There is now a woman of color who is serving as the editor. Interesting background that she has. She was the front office clerk at the paper before assuming this role. Her degrees are basically in counseling and human resources type roles, not human management, more than editorial type of history or background.
Yeah, and when you go and you read the story, what you're going to find out is that she actually confronted him about this after it became public, and he saw this as a way in which to get himself out of this situation and not be the front face of it, even though he still owns it.
I don't know her, but people who are questioning her qualifications, I just say, still in the United States of America, there is no license required or no test you have to take to be a journalist. And frankly, this is a small town in southern Alabama. How many trained journalists with journalism degrees want to be the editor of that paper?
Especially that paper.
This could be a really good outcome for that community,
actually. And there's some other articles that are on our links blog that kind of touch on this, that there are so many different aspects of diversity and bringing diverse voices to both our newsrooms and to the coverage that we provide our audiences, that maybe having that different background could lead to better coverage.
Yeah, at least that's what they're hoping. And she actually talked about that and saying she's going to take this as an opportunity to pull the community together and maybe move further and be more progressive in what's going on down there.
Okay, well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending your last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about today on our links blog. You can find that under both the programs and podcasts tabs at kbia.org. Our archive is also available on iTunes or wherever it is you get your favorite podcasts. Look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.